On this week's On the Media, abducting journalists for PR or profit is the way of ISIS, and it blinds and deafens the world.
The civil war in Syria has made it the world's most dangerous place for journalists.
We've been in the longest, watched everyone else go home, never stopped believing, and then wham, have some of that. You're not worth negotiating for.
The word negotiate has come to mean capitulation and acquiescence. And negotiations is simply a dialogue. It's simply a channel of communication.
I was trying to look for him. I was just texting him many, many times. Later, I found out Abu'l-Majid was beheaded in Palmyra.
I feel like it's my obligation to let them know that it's on our watch that this is happening, this slow-motion genocide.
I don't know if you can understand, but this is our destiny, to stay here and to die here.
The tangled web of kidnapped reporters. Stay tuned. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Monday is Memorial Day. Some argue that it was first unofficially observed in Charleston in the spring of 1865, when former slaves exhumed 257 Union soldiers buried en masse in a Confederate prison camp, and then solemnly reburied them with honor. It was a two-week effort, capped by a parade led by thousands of black children.
The first formal observance came a few years later and was extended to fallen soldiers on both sides of the Civil War, and later to the military dead in all America's wars. But in this age of asymmetrical war, information war, message war, we thought we'd take the occasion to recall certain journalists lost in the field. Not necessarily dead, lost.
Hello there. I'm John Cantley, the British citizen abandoned by my government and a long-term prisoner of the Islamic State. In this program, we'll see how the Western governments are hastily marching towards all-out war in Iraq.
British journalist John Cantley was kidnapped by ISIS in Syria, along with American freelance reporter James Foley, in November 2012. Foley was beheaded. Cantley's head was preserved.
I'm going to show you the truth behind the systems and motivation of the Islamic State and how the Western media, the very organization I used to work for, can twist and manipulate that truth.
Periodically, he pops up in ISIS propaganda, either as captive or playing a reporter determinedly, as if his life depended on it. Which, of course, it does.
In an issue of the ISIS magazine Dabiq last year, Cantley urged his family, fighting for his release with no apparent help from the British government, to stop. Let it go, he wrote. Get on with your lives.
We are patrolling the streets of Mosul. It's been a while since I've ridden a motorcycle, so it seems that the police are almost redundant. There's really very little crime being committed.
But Cantley had a life before. As the BBC noted, his portfolio was stacked with adventure features ranging from extreme sports to off-road motorcycling.
I'm about to ride the most expensive and fastest Italian sports bike on the market.
He was known as a seasoned professional who got the job done with an abundance of good humor.
I'm about to ride this 140-horsepower beast around 300 square meters of 50-year-old tarmac. Are you ready for this kind of experience?
This is ridiculous. I can't work in these conditions. I have standards.
A journalist who had worked in some of the most dangerous countries in the world, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Syria.
This is how we secretly got into Syria, very quietly.
Yeah.
Nobody can hear us arrive. Top secret.
After 2 weeks, it was time to leave the arable fields and olive groves of northern Syria. We'd seen just a fraction of what the Assad regime is doing to its citizens, but it's pretty shocking.
When we planned this hour, we were hoping to hear what Cantley's colleagues, his friends and family, and his government would say about him. But we soon learned that almost no one would say anything. They feared their words could hasten his death. And some of them are also uneasy with the role he's taken on. So we decided to use the plight of John Cantley as the fulcrum for a broader exploration of the challenges now confronting intrepid chroniclers of war. The era is long past when reporters could move between warring camps without explicit targets on their backs. The era is long past when most journalists had powerful media companies to defend them. And it's long past when combatants needed reporters to get their stories out. Oh, they're still useful in shaping narratives, but not as interpreters, rather as cash cows, public relations pawns, and feature players in snuff videos.
But Cantley's role in the ISIS media machine is, as far as we can tell, unique.
It's an example of Islamic State's impressive defiance in the face of the rest of the world, and the fact that they have got this guy who's from a crusader country basically towing the line. I think that that energizes people.
Charlie Winter, based at Georgia State University's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative, is an ISIS expert. He says whether Cantley believes or does not believe the things he says is beside the point.
There has been this sort of narrative of whether Cantley has gone to the other side, whether he believes the things he's saying. I mean, this is a man who's been held by Islamic State for a number of years now, and he is in total self-preservation mode. If he's saying things that the propagandists want him to say and he's saying them convincingly, then that's going to improve his chances of survival. I do think it's kind of irrelevant to question where his loyalties lie.
Sunni Muslims can now walk on the streets of Mosul without fear of Shia oppression. I'm struck by just how normal and crazy and busy everything is. This is not a city living in fear, as the Western media would have you believe.
Cantley's first kidnap occurred when he illegally slipped into Syria in July 2012. He was shot and badly wounded during an escape attempt. A week after his abduction, he was rescued by forces of the Free Syrian Army fighting the rule of Bashar al-Assad. His second abduction occurred soon after the first one and at nearly the same place. Since then, former fellow captives have spoken of special tortures inflicted on British and American prisoners, including waterboarding.
Nearly 2 years after Cantley was taken, his friend and editor at the Telegraph newspaper, Colin Freeman, wrote, quote, "Some of the reporting of his predicament has painted him as the author of his own plight, a devil-may-care adrenaline junkie who didn't know where to draw the line." But, Freeman continued, "That isn't the John I know. The John I know is aware of the dangers all too well, but chose to face them in order to document the brutality of the Assad regime firsthand." French journalist Nicolas Henin shared a cell with Cantley and others until his ransom was paid.
Cantley is a great journalist. He is a wonderful storyteller. So they realized the asset that he is for them. And they played a bit with him, doing some reporting for their sake. When you are hostage, you are just merchandise. You're just something that you keep in the fridge and waiting for a good use.
And so he remains in the fridge until retrieved by ISIS, looking ever more shrunken and sapped. In a BBC interview after his first abduction, Cantley shared some of what went through his mind while in captivity.
There were times when I actually thought, what does it feel like when you're shot in the back of the head, you know, when you're kneeling and blindfolded, you know, is there pain? Does it just go dark? Then when, you know, they were sharpening the knives, you're like, you know, what does it feel like when someone pulls your head back and actually slices your throat? Can you taste the blood gurgling down your windpipe? These are not nice thoughts.
These days, of course, we cannot know his thoughts. Just before his comrade in captivity, the journalist Jim Foley was beheaded, Foley spoke words put into his mouth by his murderers. No one condemns him for that. Unlike the outpouring of support and heartbreak that followed Foley's death, Cantley's sporadic appearances seem to inspire a kind of indifference.
Case in point, a petition has been created in Britain to raise awareness about Cantley's plight. All such petitions run for 6 months. At least 10,000 signatures are required to get the British government to respond. 100,000 are required to make it a parliamentary debate. The deadline is August 8th. So far, it has 3,800.
Coming up, why journalists are such ripe and ready targets, and why you should care.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. John Cantley was abducted in Syria just months after suffering through another kidnapping ordeal there. So why did he go back?
John wanted to return to Syria because he was trying to write an article about his initial kidnapping. He had publications that were interested in it, and it was a way for him to recoup some of the money or equipment that he had lost.
Freelance photojournalist Nicole Tung, who worked with Cantley on previous reporting trips to Syria, believes that this kind of project, write a piece about your first kidnapping because it's a story that'll sell, is something a freelancer would do.
I think that he certainly took more risk to get that story for the purposes of regaining lost equipment. And as a freelancer, when you don't have a big company to back you, it's thousands of dollars, usually out of the freelancer's own pocket.
Just before Cantley took off, he wrote his editor at The Telegraph, Colin Freeman, that he was going to, quote, get back on the horse after falling off, so to speak. And he asked, does my doing this label me as a lunatic in the eyes of editors and therefore damage my reputation as someone they might use? Freeman wrote in a post that with hindsight, he wished he'd said an emphatic yes. But Freeman also wrote, I doubt John even saw it as much of a choice. John's a frontline specialist, and back in 2012, Syria was, frankly, the only place for anyone in his line of work to be. No doubt, but Nicole Tung says that freelancers are compelled to calculate risk factors differently from staff reporters. Consider how John Cantley and James Foley, on the day that they were kidnapped, chose to travel to the Turkish side of the border where they were to meet Nicole.
They took a taxi from the town that they were in Syria, to the border, which normally, you know, is a big no-no, but we can't afford hired drivers and trusted people to take us to certain places. So we, you know, jump in the next taxi.
When the Syrian uprising began in 2011, big news outlets had staff reporters on the ground. But then,
Gilles Jacquier, an award-winning cameraman for France 2 Television, was reportedly killed by grenades.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Anthony Shadid died yesterday during an assignment in Syria for the New York Times.
The life and legacy of Marie Colvin, killed in Syria yesterday, just a few hours.
As Western outlets began to pull back, freelancers quickly filled the gap. But as the threat of kidnapping mounted, their numbers dwindled. For staff reporters and freelancers alike, options were limited. Either get a visa from the Syrian government and follow the regime script, or cross the border illegally and risk a fatal outcome.
The civil war in Syria has made it the world's most dangerous place for journalists.
There are at least 30 journalists that have been kidnapped in Syria.
At least 50 journalists and media workers have been killed there since the start of 2013.
And so news outlets began to rely on other sources, namely online communication with activists, local reporters, and everyday people inside Syria. By assembling fragments and vetting by triangulating accounts, they could paint a picture, albeit a grainier one, of what was going on. Hoida Saad is a reporter and news assistant in the Beirut Bureau of the New York Times. The daughter of a cafeteria worker who for years helped manage the Lebanese office of a Syrian auto supply company, she got into journalism by doing some translation work as a favor. With The Times since 2008, she now maintains a network of more than 1,000 contacts on Skype, WhatsApp, and Facebook. Rebel fighters, government officials, soldiers, jihadists, and citizens caught up in the conflict. She says that, oddly enough, her own late-night online shopping habit helped in cultivating those sources.
It was very hard to chat with those people during the day because they were busy. And usually the Syrians, they don't sleep early. And at 12 or 1 a.m., it's the only time I have to do online shopping to check what is the latest for fashion. I was looking at the tops and dresses, and then suddenly those fighters are back, or the activists, and they want to chat. Hearing women's voice coming through Skype, it makes them relax. And they will tell me stories about what's happening.
What was actually happening in the field.
Yes. We wrote a story about this guy, Abu Bilal Humsi, who was a regular activist, and then he became an ISIS fighter.
Were you able to track his conversion?
We used to chat every single day. He was religious, but not extremist. He tells me updates from Homs. He was, you know, besieged. And he used to tell me jokes about his daily life. But later, gradually, I started feeling there is something changing in his character, really changing. He told me I joined the Islamic State. And he continued chatting with me. But later on, I found out he blew himself up in Homs and he killed people. Maybe some of them he used to know, you know, who was grown up in this neighborhood. And, you know, it's a war.
In addition to gleaning information, you have become a kind of go-between for people. There was one couple, the wife lived in one place, the husband had been evacuated to another. They were both talking to you.
That wife, 9 months, she can't see her husband. She tells me, I'm going to get divorced. On the other side, the husband, he texts me and he tells me, please, could you keep chatting with my wife? Just calm her down, tell her funny stories. Could you please tell her that I love her?
What kind of work goes into keeping up all of these contacts?
You should check on those people every day, every single day, to show them like it's not only purely business. Some of them, they risk their lives to tell me. They go to a place where sometimes there are explosions. Sometimes I tell them, no, please don't go, but they insist to do it because they want their stories to be told, to be heard.
The Times says that you're a vital source of Syrian contacts. Are there stories that couldn't have been done but for your chatting, I understand, for 6 hours a day through Skype and other means?
Of course, I will give you an example. It was one of the most painful experiences in my life. The story of the soldier I met in Palmyra during a visit more than a year ago. And somehow, I don't know, he took my number and when I came back, he sent me a message, hello. And that soldier was depressed. You know, he was young, 21 years old. He wants to live his life. He wants to date. He wants to be in love. He wants to see his mother. But at the same time, he can't. He's a soldier. He's serving in the worst place in the world. Every day, like, he's facing ISIS. He used to send me updates every single day. You know, today we've had battles with ISIS. Today I dated this woman. It was like daily for a year.
Was he working for the Syrian government?
He was a police with the Syrian government. He considered me his best friend. Most of his friends, they were serving in Palmyra, and when ISIS stormed, they were beheaded. And I was trying to calm him down, and, you know, he was telling me, wait, I don't want to go back to Palmyra. And I told him, no, don't go. But a few days later, he sent me 2 pictures, and he told me, this might be the last pictures. I'm heading to Palmyra now. And then he went offline and, you know, I was trying to look for him, to ask, to check what happened to him. Abul Majid, where are you? I was just texting him many, many times. Later, I found out Abul Majid was beheaded in Palmyra outside the mosque by ISIS. And I don't want to miss this point, Brooke, but throughout my contacts with these people, I received so many messages like Abul Majid messages, they telling me goodbye.
How does the loss of so many of these people who are your contacts and not quite your friends, how does that affect you?
Sometimes I say to myself, I should stop this. You know, I'm a human being. I can't tolerate the idea like every day I'm receiving goodbye messages. Sometimes I say, okay, it's normal. This is war. You should continue and do what you're doing. But later I say, no, I cannot. You know, it's ups and downs, ups and downs. But what gives me hope, the family of those people I know, they contact me and they thank me. For instance, a mother of one of the activists I used to communicate with, she called me the other day and she said, I could feel my son through you.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, it was, wow. So, no, I should continue.
You know, this isn't something I was going to ask you, but we're trying to understand John Cantley's situation. Mm. I just wonder if you ever hear anything about him.
Actually, no. These days, it's very hard to reach people in ISIS-controlled areas. Mm-hmm. Super hard. A few months ago, I used to have contacts with the people there, like from Raqqa, from countryside of Aleppo, where ISIS is still controlling a few villages. After ISIS banned all means of communications mm-hmm. in these areas, I don't know anything. These days, I'm trying to get news through families. Families who live in Turkey and I don't know where. They contacting their families in ISIS-controlled areas, and then this is the way they tell me. But it's very frustrating, really very frustrating and very depressing. And that's why I continue to do more shopping, online shopping. It helps me. Like, I can see something nice in this world. You know, my mother keeps complaining. She said, you know, you should stop that.
Stop shopping or stop talking to contacts?
Stop the shopping. Stop talking. That's impossible. This is something I cannot stop it. You know, like.
It's wonderful talking to you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Brule. Thank you.
Huwaid Assad is based in the Beirut Bureau of the New York Times. Janine DiGiovanni is the Middle East editor for Newsweek and author of the new book, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. For the last 25 years, she's been a conflict reporter. By the way, in a moment, she'll describe all the reasons Syria is uniquely hard to cover, and those descriptions at times are pretty graphic, so be warned.
People are going to turn off the television set when they see too many mass graves, too many bodies, too much bombing. But a good in-depth story is going to capture the attention of people, particularly when it has a narrative. And that's what I do. Go on the ground, spend months and months, sit on the floor with people and talk to them. For instance, one of the characters in my book, Nada, is a young activist. She was detained, raped, basically her life completely shattered. So what I did is used her as a vehicle to tell the story of rape in Syria. I get a lot of letters from people who've read my book and they say, I didn't know this was happening. Now, it's kind of strange from where I'm sitting to believe that people don't know that there are thousands and thousands of people in detention in Syria who are being tortured this very second. But it's true, because if you're sitting in California or Nebraska or New Jersey, you're thinking about your own life. Syria is someone else's war. But I feel like it's my obligation to let them know that it's on our watch that this is happening, this slow-motion genocide.
You recount stories of atrocities committed by the Syrian regime against the opposition. The young woman revolutionary thrown in prison, raped, forced to drink the urine of a fellow prisoner.
That's Nada.
Someone thrown into a cell with corpses. The horrors almost beyond comprehension. Do you think the regime's crimes are underreported?
The majority of atrocities are being committed by the regime. But the opposition are not angels. And now there's the added dimension of ISIS and al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. I tried to point out crimes on both sides, but my focus was always victims of state terror. And having lived through Bosnia, Rwanda, Kosovo, Somalia, Chechnya, Afghanistan, Iraq, and having interviewed at this point hundreds and hundreds of people who've been tortured over the years, I have to say some of the worst reports that came to me were people talking to me about what happened to them in Syria.
Do you think that the regime has been effective in using ISIS as a distraction from its own crimes?
Absolutely. ISIS has led the narrative, and it's not about ISIS. It's about the Syrian people killed, raped, villages being burned. ISIS is a horror, a catastrophe, but it's one element of this war. And I think people have all but abandoned the civilian story.
What do you most wish the public would understand about Syria?
I walk my son to school in the morning, and I want people to know what it's like when you can't walk your kids to school because there is no school. They haven't been in school for 5 years, which is an entire primary school education. You have kids who are starving, and you've got to go to a bakery at 5 a.m, the only bakery in Aleppo, stand in line for 5, 6, 7 hours, and by the time you get to the top of the line, There's no more bread. You've got diabetes or cancer, and the hospitals are all bombed. The only pediatrician in Aleppo was killed when the hospital was deliberately targeted and bombed. Your life stops. It's only by sheer coincidence that you weren't born there, I wasn't born there. And that's all I want people to do, is to try to put themselves in the shoes of those people, just for 5 minutes, longer if they can hold on.
Can you tell me a story about reporting in Syria that would defy public expectations, something that surprised you?
Well, I think it would have to be the story of Hassan. Hassan was a philosophy student living in Homs. And one day, during heavy shelling, the regime forces shot through the door, and he was taken to a detention center. They basically operated on him without anesthetic and removed some of his organs. He then was sewn up, hung, and beaten. And while he was being beaten, a doctor came to take his pulse, which is customary with torture victims, to see how much more they could endure. And this doctor said, "I can't stand this anymore, but I'm a regime doctor. So listen to me very carefully. I am declaring you dead. You will be taken to the morgue, and if God has meant it to be, you'll find your way out somehow." And Hassan was thrown into a morgue on top of a pile of corpses, and he was rescued in the most extraordinary way. It's one of those stories that makes you really believe that people in times of war can be extraordinarily bad or extraordinarily good and brave and heroic.
Janine DiGiovanni is author of the new book, The Morning They Came for Us, Dispatches from Syria. If foreign journalists are motivated by the idea that people would care if they got the real story, those inside Syria, sources for people like DiGiovanni and Hweda Saad, are driven by the need to help them get that story right.
I'm Firas Ansaid. I'm an activist in the Talbisa Media Center.
Firas is a citizen journalist in a rebel-held suburb of Homs and an ardent opponent of the Assad regime. After recent Russian airstrikes on his town, he talked to news outlets ranging from CNN to the BBC, but he hasn't much faith in the international press.
They are not depending on the people here on the ground. They are depending all the time on the government propaganda and the government media.
Along with a handful of other activists, he spends his days chronicling what's happening around him and posting updates to Facebook and YouTube.
We are reporting the crimes of Assad forces. We are using the internet to upload the videos, to upload news about what's going on in the city. Most of the time, we are wandering in the city to see what happened and how people are living. Some of people will ask us, "Why you are filming the dead people? Nobody will care about them. Just let them die silently." But we cannot do that. We have to report everything. Maybe now that will not be useful, but after a while it will.
Firas had a chance to escape this bloodshed. In 2011, when the uprising began, he went to the United Arab Emirates. But after a year, as his fellow countrymen were pouring out of Syria, he returned to a hometown under siege.
We lost a lot of our friends, our relatives here. We cannot leave this country. I don't know if you can understand, but this is our destiny, to stay here and to die here. Because maybe it's too late to think about leaving. It's too late. We decided to stay, and we have to continue that. We have to continue what we have started.
Even if the gaze of the world outside has wandered off, Firas al-Sayed will continue to chronicle to the cloud for those who still care and for history.
Coming up, why some reporters live to tell the tale and some don't. The world's tangled policy on hostages.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In almost every one of the ISIS videos in which John Cantley appears, he identifies himself like this.
Hello there. I'm John Cantley, the British citizen abandoned by my government.
And in one of those videos, in between explaining the triumphs of the Islamic State and the warped Western media, he speaks for a moment with eerie conviction.
We were left to die. It's the worst feeling in the world, being left behind like that. We'd been in the longest, paid our dues, watched everyone else go home, never stopped believing, and then wham! Have some of that. You're not worth negotiating for. To be left behind so cynically by the country you thought you knew was some kind of ultimate betrayal.
Those words, whether his true belief or not, can't but electrify the long-standing debate about how to get hostages home, a debate that's escalated in the last few years with the rise of ISIS and the spate of kidnappings, back-channel releases, and brutal public murders.
American journalist Stephen Sotloff of Time magazine, held by ISIS, reportedly has been beheaded in Syria.
The video that was posted Saturday night showed the killing of David Haynes and showed a threat to kill another British hostage.
The terror group has released this video showing the apparent beheading of Alan Henning. He's the fourth Western captive killed by ISIS since August.
The core question, should governments pay or assist in paying ransom in exchange for our citizens, or should they refuse, as our government does, lest rewarding kidnapping begets more kidnappings? Other countries embrace a third way. France, Spain, Italy, and other European governments publicly deny paying ransoms, but they do. Others, like Denmark, facilitate payments from families of hostages. Not so the U.S. or the U.K.
The theory being that with such a rigid and flexible stance, the terrorists will realize there's nothing to be gained by holding an American hostage, and therefore they will either avoid taking a hostage or will let them go because they're not going to gain anything from it.
Gary Nesner is a former hostage negotiator for the FBI.
It may sound reasonable and logical, but it simply doesn't work that way. I think it's clear that Americans still remain very desirable targets for many terrorist groups.
While leading the FBI's crisis negotiation unit from 1990 to 2003, Nesner handled more than 120 overseas kidnapping cases.
The word negotiate, Bob, has come to mean capitulation and acquiescence. And negotiations is simply a dialogue. It's simply a channel of communication. And there are innumerable reasons why that works to our benefit.
Among them, intelligence gathered during the process. Another, forestalling a violent conclusion. A dialogue, Nesner says, at least suggests to hostage takers that there might be some eventual benefit, so they keep the hostage alive. He reflects on a case in which missionaries were kidnapped by the Colombian FARC group.
And the missionary organization said, we're going to tell these people in no uncertain terms that we will never negotiate with them. And the terrorists killed three hostages. You never want to slam the door shut like that.
Open communication also helps clarify the captors' ultimate goals, whether publicity, money, or something else.
I worked a case in Africa many years ago where they wanted money, but we ended up giving them office supplies and camping equipment, and that sufficed.
ISIS isn't in it for the paper clips and propane stoves, but point taken. Hostages are a commodity in a marketplace, a bizarre bazaar.
And one of the common mistakes that anyone makes, including people in government, is they hear an initial demand. We want $100 million. And they say, we're not going to pay $100 million. Well, in most of the developing world where these kidnappings occur, even terrorist ones, kidnap payouts range about 10% of what the initial demand was.
Like buying a pashmina in a bazaar, there's the starting price and then there's the transaction price.
Well, that's right. You've got to haggle it down. It's expected. It's cultural. We're not very good at that in the United States.
Nesner says that when he worked at the FBI in the 90s and early 2000s, the ransom question was met with greater flexibility. The government never paid, but the State Department did not stop families from paying.
If they determined to do it, we would help them do it safely and smartly. What happened, I think, is post 9/11, there began a slow tightening of the interpretation of what the FBI could do.
It got kind of complicated and confusing for us as families because we were hearing different things from different branches of the government.
Diane Foley is the mother of late journalist and ISIS hostage James Foley. While the family was fighting for his release, the FBI urged them to be in touch with James' captors. But the State Department warned of prosecution if they paid a ransom. The right hand didn't know what the left hand was threatening, creating anxiety and confusion now addressed by an interagency hostage task force called a fusion cell.
Since Jim's death, the hostage review that was done and the new formation of the hostage recovery fusion cell now has State Department co-located with FBI and intelligence. That in itself is a huge improvement.
The fusion cell is a sort of war room staffed by members of the Departments of Justice, Defense, State, Treasury, Intelligence, and the FBI. It's a fix for the turf wars and poor communication that have often muddled the government's response. The no U.S. concessions to terrorists rule hasn't changed, but families will not be prosecuted for paying ransoms. Diane Foley herself was deeply involved in the government's review and has become a hostage family champion, advocating passionately for a hard look at the policy the U.S. stands so firmly by. Mainly, the assumption that refusing to make concessions depresses the market for American hostages.
There was recently a report put out by West Point that actually showed that Americans are being captured at the same rate as other citizens around the world. So we need to make sure that our current policy does protect us, right?
Gary Nesner echoes that sentiment.
There is no data that I can find that would suggest, for example, that a gang of terrorists grabs an American and then all of a sudden has an epiphany and says, oh, we've grabbed an American by mistake, so we're not going to get any money, so let's let him go.
I really think we need to come together as Western allies. Jim was with 17 other Westerners, three of whom were Americans, but we had Italy, France, the United Kingdom, Germany, and yet each country handled it themselves. And if we had come together, you know, who knows? There might have been possibility of everyone being freed.
Perhaps, but the fundamental tension still remains between a family's wishes and the government's philosophy, between what we think is sound policy and what we'd do if it were us. Indeed, the fates of nearly two dozen ISIS hostages held in the same prison seem to reflect the different policies in the starkest way possible. The European hostages were released, those from the UK and the US were killed. Gary Nesner.
I don't agree with European countries having paid large sums, and I don't think the U.S. government should ever pay a penny. However, there is a much lower expectation of what a family could pay versus a government. So we're starting out in a whole different bargaining position. Envision it being that daughter of yours, and somebody says, if you don't pay $100,000, she's dead. Well, you're going to come up with some money. It may not be $100,000, but you're going to negotiate and come up with some money. It's your family member. And that's the dilemma people get in. And I think often some government officials don't understand.
Diane Foley, grieving mother turned activist, has helped inject human emotion and perhaps common sense into the process. Like many victims of family tragedy, she's still trying to fill the unfillable void with meaning and purpose.
Jim would have wanted all American hostages to come home. He would have wanted families supported, and he definitely would have wanted conflict journalists, particularly the independent ones, to be safer so that they could do their work. So that is our work. I feel as long as we're still on Earth, it's my role and our challenge to continue to do our best to make it a better world. That's the only way, as far as I'm concerned. Got to try, Bob. We got to keep trying.
Among Diane's efforts has been to help fund Hostage US, a new organization dedicated to assisting hostage families through their ordeals. Rachel Briggs, who runs Hostage US and helped found its parent organization, Hostage UK, more than a decade ago, was also dragged into her vocation by grim circumstance.
As a very young 19-year-old at university 20 years ago, my uncle was kidnapped in Colombia. We spent 7.5 months not knowing whether he was alive or dead, there never being enough information, the information being confusing, a sense that you have no agency over what's going on. It was really that formative experience that determined me that something needed to be done.
Briggs' uncle returned safely. Hostage U.S. has a, quote, policy of no policy when it comes to ransoms. Instead, it aims to fill a compassion gap, helping families with the nitty-gritty, from conveying traumatic information to children to providing financial advice if a breadwinner is held captive.
For many of our families, the most contact they've had with government is getting a parking ticket. And suddenly they find themselves in the middle of this awful drama, dealing with FBI, State Department, DOJ, private security companies. We're able to help them to make sense of what's going on, give them pointers about what questions to ask, how to hold those agencies to account, really how to do their jobs as families as well as they possibly can.
Is there a top 10 list of the things that hostage families face that they simply don't anticipate as they're dragged into this process?
They might be, for example, asked for a DNA sample within the first few weeks. Well, a family's automatic reaction to that is he dead? Are you asking for this because he's dead and you're not telling me? We're able to give them reassurance that that's actually just a very routine thing to ask for early in the case so that it's on file and it's ready should it be needed. One of, I guess, the most common sources of anxiety for families is media interest. Some of them suddenly find the media camped on their doorstep, journalists threatening to break the story against their wishes. I guess the other thing is having to engage with very large bureaucracies. Picture the scene, you're the wife of a hostage and you have a minor car accident. You phone the car insurance company and their first question is, can I speak to the policyholder? Well, you can't because he's a hostage, but I can't tell you why you can't because I've been told by the government that I need to keep this secret. Families kind of find themselves paralyzed in those situations.
You are constantly immersed in other people's worst nightmares. I wonder what most appalls you about what those people go through.
I would say the thing that grinds down any family going through this situation is this constant sense of uncertainty. Day in, day out, you are hearing nothing, you are learning nothing, you have pretty much no control over the situation. I remember speaking to the elderly mother of a hostage who was going into work every day in her local hospital and was having to keep the secret that her son was being held overseas and answering questions. How is he? Yeah, he's doing great. He's still on his travels. The pressure that that puts on somebody is unimaginable. And of course, her colleagues only found out when they read in the newspapers about his brutal murder. I guess what we're able to do is be one of the few people in their lives that they can speak openly about what's going on.
Rachel Briggs is the director of Hostage US and Hostage UK. Demra and Mark Tice are the parents of Austin Tice, a freelance American journalist who disappeared in Syria nearly 4 years ago. At age 30, Austin went abroad with the purest of intentions to report firsthand what befell the people there. He had little experience, but a lot of verve and nerve, venturing deeper into Syria than nearly any other Western journalist. Within a month, he was filing stories for McClatchy and The Washington Post, appearing on CBS and giving interviews to NPR.
From what I've seen, when the rebels fight, the civilians come out in the streets and leave them, you know, platters of food and pitchers of water to support them when they're fighting.
Then, in August 2012, he vanished. 6 nightmarish weeks later, his family saw evidence of life, a video showing him being led blindfolded up a hillside by armed, masked men.
Oh, Jesus.
Since that video, the Tices have had no communication with Austin or his captors. But they have had what they call credible recent reports that Austin is still alive, and that he isn't held either by ISIS or Syrian rebel groups. The Syrian regime denies any responsibility, but its network of militias have the means and the histories to be suspect. For its part, the U.S. government has told the Tices to be patient. Deborah Tice says that staying silent never made sense to them.
If your child goes missing in the mall, you don't go and whisper in a security guard's ear. The natural response is to start hollering your child's name, asking everyone in the mall if they've seen them, raising a ruckus.
With the help of Reporters Without Borders, the Tices have run full-page ads in major newspapers, rented billboards in their hometown of Houston, launched social media campaigns, given dozens of interviews. But despite their best efforts, they've found it next to impossible to reach the American public, even their own neighbors.
It always just floors us. You know, even now we'll get the question, well, are you guys going to go public?
That frustration was epitomized most recently at a rally at the White House organized by journalism students at Austin's alma mater, Georgetown University. It was well publicized. There was a lot of interest. It was a beautiful day, but
the attendance was small. It was small. It was great to see it. But compared to what we see in some other countries, I mean, in Lebanon, when someone goes missing, they burn tires on the highway. In 2015, I was in Paris for World Press Freedom Day, and there were thousands of people there. When one of their citizens is taken missing, they throw banners on their tallest buildings and say, "We will not stand for our people being taken, and we will bring them home." I'm not really sure, Bob, why we can't get that kind of groundswell in America.
Is it hostage fatigue?
I think it's really about what are people invested in? What are they passionate about? And how the modern news cycle, you know, is constantly changing. You can't keep your message on top for long.
There was a very sympathetic piece about Austin and you in Texas Monthly. But at the end of it, there was this description of you as having become, I think it said, a full-time hostage family. And I wonder what percentage of that is the realistic notion that you can help secure Austin's release, and what percentage of it is just a coping mechanism.
There's no doubt that Deborah and I both feel strongest when we're taking action. On the other hand, we found out very early, you know, and this is an old cliche, you know, don't worry, the government's here, they're going to help you. That just wasn't the case. So we not only felt like we had to figure out what we could do, but that it was actually necessary.
And what happens every time the phone rings?
Well, we don't jump anymore, but we do answer it every time it rings in the middle of the night. And the last thing that both of us do before we hit the pillow is check all of our Google alerts, our Twitter feeds, search the internet for anything new. Deborah does way too much of that in the middle of the night.
It's not the middle of the night on the other side of the world.
There you go.
We are a hostage family. Austin has 6 siblings, and even though his youngest brother is 22, they have sorely missed their parents these last 3 years and 9 months. And to fill the gap that Mark, and especially me, the only job that I've ever had is to be the mom, they have really held it together for each other through college graduations and weddings, big life events, where it would have been so different if I had been fully present. And I do think they're quite tired of it.
Early on in his expedition, to people who asked him, "What in the world are you up to?" Austin wrote a Facebook post. I'm just going to read a portion of it. Our granddads stormed Normandy and Iwo Jima and defeated global fascism. Neil Armstrong flew to the moon in a glorified trash can, doing math on a clipboard as he went. Sometime between when our granddads licked the Nazis and when we started putting warnings on our coffee cups about the temperature of our beverage, America lost that pioneering spirit. We became a fat, weak, complacent, coddled, unambitious, and cowardly nation. So that's why I came here to Syria, and it's why I like being here now, right in the middle of a brutal and still uncertain civil war. This is a manifesto about a life with purpose.
You know, it's that fearless sense of calling that fills our history books with heroes.
Deborah and Mark Tice are the parents of Austin Tice, the freelance American journalist who disappeared in Syria in August 2012.
All the kidnapped reporters, living or dead, shared that fearless sense of calling to break the silence and to tell the truth. In the end, they're either ransomed or vanished or beheaded after condemning the West. Only John Cantley must break the silence again and again with words that have no relevance to truth. A mythical torture, right? When Prometheus stole fire from mankind, Zeus chained him to a rock where daily an eagle ate his liver, which was nightly regenerated. He was kept alive, like Cantley. Of course, Prometheus eventually was freed by Hercules. We haven't yet gotten to the end of Cantley's story.
This week's show was produced almost entirely by Meera Sharma.
I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.